This is the Horse Radio Network.
What a beautiful day for horses in the morning.
Hi, I'm Coach Jen from Ocala, Florida, and you're listening to Horses in the Morning on the Horse Radio Network for March 23rd, episode 1658. This episode is brought to you by listeners like you. Thank you, auditors. Good morning, Horse World.
Good morning!
It's Thursday.
Let's kick the tires and light the fires, Big Daddy.
Your presence is required on the command deck.
Well, in honor of our Road to the Horse coverage that starts tomorrow, we thought we'd provide a little fun from our favorite former Road to the Horse competitor, Mary Kitzmiller. This time she explains teaching a horse to lay down, and then she has a chat with extreme horse gal Waylene Wilson about putting a handle on a horse. And then we'll jump into the Wayback Machine for an interview that we did way back in 2012 with the mad genius behind Extreme Mountain Trail, Mark Bolender. Stay tuned for the fray, folks.
You know, Mary has been a regular guest on the show since March, I think, of last year. And you played a couple of the games with us and won some and lost some, like the rest of us have. But you've always been a good sport about it. Anytime I asked Mary, she would come on and do it, and I really appreciate that. Mary's going to be doing a training episode with us the second Thursday of every month from now on, and we're excited to have her aboard. And, of course, you know, training is something that we can talk endlessly about when it comes to horses and riders. And Mary brings a different perspective in that she has had a lot of experience in this world, and we're going to talk a lot more about that, getting to know Mary a little bit in the first part of the show. But first off, Jennifer is going to tell us what is coming up on today's show.
On today's Training with Mary Thursday adventure, Mary lays down the law with her training tip, teaching your horse to lay down on command. And then next up, Sean Patrick stops by with an update on how his upcoming New Smyrna Beach Symposium has come together. What can you think of that's better than going to New Smyrna Beach, Florida, in the middle of winter to do horse stuff? And skidding into the finish, Waylene Wilson puts a handle on a horse. So stay tuned for the fray, folks.
Thank you, Jennifer. Well, you know, it is going to be fun to see you. We're hoping to get over. You're going to be coming to Florida here in a couple of weeks, and you'll be going down to Sean's place. We'll talk about that a little bit later in the show. But hopefully we'll get over and get to say hi and get to see you again. So that'll be fun.
Yeah,
well, Mary,
I can't wait.
Let's talk a little bit about you. The audience, some of them will know you from your appearances on the show here and from the Road to the Horse coverage. But so we have a lot of new listeners as well. So let's get to know you a little bit. I was reading your bio, and it was fascinating. And I know he died when you were young, and you never really got to meet him. But you were the granddaughter of a rodeo cowboy who did some amazing things.
That's right. My grandpa, my mom's dad, was a cowboy in every sense of the word. And he's from, I believe the family's from South Dakota. They're up in Wyoming, and he did everything. He was all around cowboy until he stopped the bull riding. I guess his best friend broke his back doing it. But he did all the other events you can do at rodeo. He broke horses for the cavalry, and he rode in Madison Square Gardens for Buffalo Bill's Wild West show. And
I've
got to know him through pictures. We've got a lot of great photos of him on horses, and because of that, my mom always, you know, she wanted a horse her entire life, and she never got to live that out until I came along. And so my first horse was really her first horse. So I think I'm the only one in my family who's really kind of carrying on the horse tradition.
Oh, was that right? Do you have brothers, sisters?
I have a brother, and he is in the Army, and fixing to head overseas once again. And I think he did a tour in Afghanistan, and he was on a horse until he fell off, and then that was about it. but he decided special forces training was much easier.
That's safer than riding horses.
Exactly.
Let's go out and get shot at. That's much better.
Yeah, that's his cup of tea. And then of course, you know, he realized you have to clean up after the horse. So we both rode when we were kids, and I was kind of the one who stuck with it and kept on going.
Now, did you do what kind of riding did you do when you were a kid?
Well, the barn we went to, they just started me English. I was totally expecting to go and ride Western, and I think they had Western riding, but for some reason they threw me an English saddle and a helmet, and so that's what I did for several years. And I rode, meddled in hunters and did a little bit of jumping and cross country and dressage, and that's what I did up until I got into mules.
So I didn't realize you did all of that you actually jumped and stuff.
Yeah, not very high. Probably the highest I ever went was about 3 feet. So, but yeah, that's what I did. Yeah, that was what I decided to. That was plenty good.
Now, did you ever have a desire? Do you ever have a desire now? Obviously, you went Western there at some point. Do you ever have a desire now to go back and ride English again at any point?
Not like as a profession or full time, but yes, I really want to go back and take some jumping lessons because for some reason, all these Western events I've been doing, they throw in these massive jumps. They threw one at us last year at Road to the Horse. We had to jump this huge thing of burlap that was about 2'6". And when you're jumping in a Western saddle, if you don't get your position right, it gets a bit weird. And I noticed my timing with horses over obstacles has gotten a little bit off. So I want to get back into English and work on kind of the fundamentals of jumping in my seat and just to improve my seat. I had a really good seat when I rode English, and you know, when you're training and especially when you're riding Western, you kind of start depending on that Western saddle a little bit and you lose your seat a little bit. So I'd love to get back into it.
You were being kind. When you jump incorrectly in a Western saddle, it just plain hurts. You were being kind.
It's no fun. Well, yeah. And I'm trying to jump my current horse, Guthrie, to get him ready because I know there will be a jump in that obstacle course. I can't tell you how many times I've lost both stirrups, landed on his neck, and because he's not a jumper either. So it's the blind leading blind.
Well, let's, before we get to modern day, let's talk a little bit, too. A lot of people may not know that you went to college and have a degree in something that we wouldn't expect.
Yeah, you know, I was just always kind of assumed I would go to college, which I think was a really good idea to do that. And I've drawn ever since I was little, and of course I drew horses, and so I went to school for art. I majored in fine arts, and I got in trouble because I made every project I wanted to make it about horses, and so I went and got my degree, which I'm glad I did. But it was about my senior year I decided I was skipping classes to ride horses, and I thought, you know, if I go and get a career in something. I had a minor in marketing, so I thought maybe graphic design, and I decided, you know, if I get a job after college, as you're prone to do, I wouldn't get to spend as much time with the horses. So I kind of just put my diploma in a drawer and decided to go be an assistant trainer and start horses.
That's what everybody does with their diplomas that are horse people. That's what
exactly
happens.
Exactly.
Now, I can see the professor coming up to you saying, okay, now this was supposed to be a still life of fruit. Why does the orange look like a horse head?
That's exactly how it went. Yeah, he'd say, I want you to paint something in the style of Mondrian. I'm like, can it be a Mondrian horse? You know, but, and he, we were supposed to do a sculpture, and my professor, I had been playing around with pipe cleaners, you know, because my mom owns a shop, and I was sitting in her shop working at the shop down the road one day and making these little sculptures out of pipe cleaners. I said, can I make something out of that? He goes, don't you think that's a bit childish? So then I had to do it. So I spent all weekend, and I made a pipe cleaner horse, a rearing horse, and he was about 4 feet tall.
Out of pipe cleaners? 4 feet tall?
That's
a lot of pipe cleaners.
It was hundreds of pipe cleaners. And a 3D horse, and he ended up, I got picked for the student art show that year because of that horse.
Wow. Made out of pipe cleaners. Well, you went on and obviously have had a successful career in the horse world. But, you know, one of the things that was on your resume, and we haven't had a chance to talk about a lot here on the show, is your work with mules. You actually showed mules for years.
Yeah, I kind of fell into mules, and I love them. They're wonderful, wonderful animals. And my mom wanted a mule, and I was like, "You're crazy. What do we do with it? We don't pack anything." And we ended up going to a sale and buying one, and found out that there were mule shows. I'm like, "Well, what are they going to do with these things?" And we went to a big mule show, and it was just like an AQHA show. And I thought, oh my gosh, this is cool. They're doing Western pleasure. They're doing horsemanship, only it's called mulemanship. And then if you show donkey, it's donkeymanship. And they're jumping them. They're running barrels, which donkey barrel racing is very thrilling to watch. And so I showed mules for several years, and I still have my first really successful show mule. He's sitting in my barn right now. And they're great animals. And I tell horse trainers, you know, I get asked by horse trainers from time to time, someone wants me to bring in a mule. You know, what do you think? How are they different? And I don't know who said it. It might have been Pat Pirelli, but he said, a mule is like a horse, only more so. And that's exactly right. And, you know, if you're a horse trainer, training mules is like graduate work for horse training.
Oh, yeah, I can see that. It just takes it up another notch. Yeah, interesting. I mean, there's so much we can talk about here. I'm trying to give the audience a little bit of an overview of who you are and where you've come from. How did you end up then wanting to get into the Mustang makeovers?
Well, you know, I actually went through a period of time where I didn't like Mustangs, believe it or not. One of the jobs where I worked, the trainer wanted us to start Mustangs and said, if you can start Mustangs, you can start anything. And I was barely experienced at starting colts. And so these Mustangs had my number. We started several of them, and they did everything that a horse can do to you. They bucked and bit and kicked and reared and struck. And I was like, oh my gosh, these are hard. I don't want anything to do with
that. Dark class.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, and the Mustang makeover rolled out, and I saw how great it was and what a success it was, and it looked really fun. I'm like, but you got to train Mustangs. But I was seeing, you know, kids working with Mustangs and women who were in their 80s working with Mustangs. I'm like, well, heck, you know, if they can do it, maybe I ought to get back into it. So I went ahead and dove right in and got a Mustang. And by then I'd had a lot more years of knowledge, a lot more patience, a lot more understanding. And so it went great. And it's been a really good ride. I've really loved it.
Now you were in the Mustang Million and came in fifth place, right?
Yes. That was kind of, that's one of my favorite little successes there.
Well, you just won $50,000. That didn't hurt.
Yeah. It's pretty nice. It made it worth it just a little bit. you about spend that much in time and energy and whatnot for that horse. It was, but it was great. I was really excited to kind of be up there with some of the people who've made their names in it, like Bobby Kerr and Tom Hagwood and Dan James. And so I was really excited to kind of be up in that group and make the finals. And I mean, there's nothing else in the world like it.
Is there something that you find with the Mustangs that has been consistent? Is there something that with the ones you've worked with that has been consistently challenging that you found with almost all of them that are one of the biggest challenges you have?
Yes, and that's the fact that they actually remind me of mules, believe it or not. They're much more flighty than your typical mule, but as flighty as a Mustang is and as fearful as they can be, you can't intimidate them to do anything. You can't kind of put the screws to them and say, you must do this. You have to constantly find ways around normal training methods to say, okay, this works with most horses, but with you, we're going to have to try something different. And that's been pretty consistent with all the Mustangs. As far as like specific training issues, I've noticed a lot of Mustangs are really tough about getting their shoulders to loosen up as far as steering and turning around. And I don't know if that has to do with the way they're built, or I've noticed that horses that are protect themselves, the last body part they want to give up is typically their shoulder. And because when you see horses kind of playing and fighting in the pasture, they're pushing each other around with their heads and necks oftentimes, and mules do this as well. And so that's kind of been a consistent, and again, because you can't intimidate them, you can't just like spur them over and say, move over. You have to constantly look for a place to release and look for a place to reward. So they're slightly different than your typical domestic horse. And quarter horses, you know, I've trained wild quarter horses, but they still have those bloodlines and they still have some experience of people. And so they kind of get on your team a lot quicker than a Mustang will.
Now, is that what led you to be noticed and then asked to do Road to the Horse Wild Card last year for the first time?
Yes, I think that was an incredibly huge help in that because, you know, although it's not Road to the Horse, the Mustang Makeover, it's a training competition. You do have to, you know, you do have to be really savvy to be able to train a wild Mustang and win. And so doing that helped for sure. And I have also gotten to know Tootie and Patty through the Mustang Makeovers, but also they've done a couple of other events, Project Cowboy and Project Cowgirl, and got to know them both through that. And Patty was gracious enough to actually write me a recommendation letter for my Road to the Horse application.
And you actually came in last year at Road to the Horse as a wild card competitor. You were second, right?
Yeah, I was really excited. I got second. That was a tough competition, but was really excited with my placing. I kind of felt like, you know, I got a pretty good deal because I went and got my second place and plenty respectable, and then I got to go watch other guys ride wild horses. So it was nice.
Yeah, we were rooting for you, though. I think the whole crowd was really rooting for you because you're one of the very few women in that world, and the whole crowd was on your side.
Yeah, I believe. You know, I'm used to going to competitions and just kind of putting your head down and competing and you know, getting congratulations from family and friends. But you go to Road to the Horse, and everybody's on your side, no matter who you are, and the response I got, especially from other women, I wasn't expecting that. You know, a lot of women came up and were really, like, excited that I was doing it and, you know, were saying, you know, you've proved, you made me think I can do it. And so it was a really cool experience. I've never had an experience like that before.
Well, and part of what you did, and I got to ask you about this, and I know it has an official name, but I come from the English side, and I know I probably should know more about it, but again, we come from the English side of things. So the whole pole dancing thing, and I maybe I should reword that, the whole riding with the pole thing.
Yeah. That's okay. It's pole dancing's cool.
It's just a different. You actually have clothes on when you're doing it. So
exactly.
Tell us about that.
Yeah, I found, I saw someone, Mark Lyon, ride in his freestyle one year at the Mustang Makeovers. Actually, he won that year with this long wooden pole, and he was turning, like, you hold the pole in one hand, and he was steering the horse with the other hand, and he was doing all these beautiful circles and lead changes and spinning under the pole, and I thought, what the heck is that? That looks really cool. And so I started researching, and it's actually called a garrocha, and I'm probably butchering how you're supposed to pronounce that. But it started in Spain, and it's actually originally used, well, I mean, the origins go back to, you know, the lance in medieval times, but typically they use it for training bullfighting bulls and for working stock. And so that was their equivalent of the lariat, and that's how they move them around. That's how they bait them to see if they have any fight in them. But then it evolved into its own. Obviously, to work that thing, it's a 13-foot-long pole, and you've got a horse that has to handle well one-handed, and you have to be really savvy in how you work it so you don't impale yourself or pole vault
right.
yourself out of the saddle.
Coordination involved.
Exactly. So it became its own discipline. So it's a little bit of dressage. It's a little bit, you know, classical riding. It's a little bit of everything. And so I started doing it in my freestyles. And I didn't think I just came up with it just to, and I actually got my first pole from Mark Lyon, who was the first one to really do it at the Mustang Makeovers. And I was just going in there because I couldn't come up with anything else. I was like, well, my horse can't sit in a car. I'm never going to be that guy. I can't really rope a cow. And, well, why don't I try this? And I decided to up the ante and take the bridle off of my horse. So not only does my horse not have a bridle, but one of my hands is occupied maneuvering this pole. And you can't fake bridleless riding if you've got a pole in your hand. If your horse is just kind of running around and you're not doing anything with the pole, people are going to know you don't really have control.
Right.
So, and it went really well. Like, people really, really liked it and really caught on, and it worked out great. So any chance I get to work with that pole, it's I love doing it. And I've started teaching clinics on how to get started with it myself because I had a lot of people ask. And it's so good for your horses.
I think what really made it special, I mean, it's pretty anyway, but what made it special was the bridleless. I mean, that just took it to that next level, which is what you have to do when you're competing at a competition like that. You can't be ordinary, because ordinary doesn't stand out in that group of competitors.
Oh, yeah. Well, and, you know, the audience has seen people work with the pole before, so you don't want them rolling their eyes, oh, another one of these. You have to take it to the next step, and eventually I'm going to be brave enough to do it bareback and bridleless with the pole one day. We'll see.
Keep working out at the gym.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah.
Well, we're going to talk more about Mary. There's so much more that we want to get to, including a little bit more about your artsy side. But right now, every month at this time, Mary's going to do a trainer's tip. So what are we talking about this month?
Well, I've got a thing I've been working on the last few years, and I've just got a DVD out about it, and that is how to get a resistance-free lay down with your horse.
Oh, okay.
And, Yeah.
It seems to be a thing. Let me ask you about that before you get into this. It does seem to be a thing now that everybody doing exhibitions and stuff like that does the lay down thing. But, you know, I don't remember 10, 15 years ago that everybody was doing it. Now it seems to be a thing.
Yeah, it's almost like required now. If you're going to do a cool exhibition, your horse should probably lay down. It's almost become a fundamental thing to do with your horse. And you know, where I first saw laying a horse down being used was with troubled horses. And that's how I was taught to do it, was with a lariat rope, and where you would pull a leg and that can be typically how it's taught. You teach it with a lariat or with a hobble, with a rope, or something like that to get your horse to the ground. And the way it's done correctly is you take a leg and you just set it up to where the horse finds it on his own. And then eventually, if you want to evolve it into something that's done on cue without any ropes, like you see in the finished exhibition, you just slowly take away the ropes and add more cues. And think, you know, once your horse is used to it, you don't need to use the ropes anymore. And so that's what a lot of people have done to get it. And that's what I've done in the past. You know, first I started it with troubled horses, and then it was done as something to show, like, you know, look, my horse can do this on cue, and it looks great, and it's really fun, it's a good photo op. And so now more and more people are doing it. But when you lay a horse down with a lariat, or even when you're working with hobbles, even if you're doing it really slow, there's a lot of risks involved. And actually, one of our guests later on the show is an expert at laying a horse down in this way, and she's very good, and she's got very good hands, and that would be Wyleen. But if you're not really experienced, there's a lot that can go wrong when you take a horse's leg up, because their legs are their only way to get away from something. So you take that away from them, and you can get a pretty big reaction. So I wanted to see if I could get it done without the ropes. And I've seen other people do it where they could just give the horse a cue and the horse lays down all on its own. And I wanted to get that from the get-go to see if I could make it happen without ever using a rope, just to see what I could do. And so that's what this DVD covers. And what we use in place of a rope or a hobble is positive reinforcement training. So what that is, positive reinforcement training, or people often know it as clicker training.
Yeah,
is,
and we've talked about that a lot. My wife Jennifer has been using it for 20 years.
Awesome! Yeah. That's great. I've started.
She
using
uses
it
for me too, Mary.
You can absolutely.
When I'm being bad, she clicks, and I know that I'm supposed to.
Oh, see, no, that wouldn't be the right way to use it, though.
Yeah.
Because with the clicker, you have to click. Yeah, if you were being bad and she clicked you, then you'd be reinforced, because the click means, yes, good, keep doing what you're doing because I like it. So you
really took it to the point, and to be honest, I wasn't always in favor of using the lariat to do that. So you've taken it to the point now where you can do it without that. I like that idea, especially using positive reinforcement.
Yeah, because I think because it's so popular, you see a lot of guys do it in demonstrations, there are more and more people who really want to do this with their horse. So I'm hoping to provide another option I'm not good with the lariat. I don't know what to look for. I don't want to burn my hands. I don't want to rope burn my horse. I don't want to end up in a bad spot. Because again, to do it that way, it can be done correctly, but you have to have very good timing. You have to have a lot of experience. So there's a way you can still get this done. It takes longer. But I think the results are really good, because it's about what it takes to get to that point where your horse feels comfortable enough to lay down next to you. So using positive reinforcement training, what the gist of how you get this done is you're going to shape the horse's behavior. So anything my horse does that looks like the lay down, I'm going to click. And I've already trained my horse to understand when he hears the click, that means good. And I use food as a motivation. And so a lot of people shy away from the food, like, oh my gosh, you know, I never do that. It's bribing my horse, or he's going to get muggy and pushy. And the way I see it, I think food is a great reward. You know, horses are prey animals, and they're motivated by safety, comfort, food. So a lot of us work hard to get the safety and comfort part right. We try to make our horse understand, you know, I'm not going to hurt you. I'm not going to put you in a dangerous situation. You know, I'm going to keep you safe. And we try to give them comfort by, when they do the right thing, we release pressure. Well, why not add that third motivator in? Because it is very powerful. And to not use a tool because you might, you know, your horse might get pushy, it's kind of like saying, well, I saddled my horse and he bucked with the saddle, so I don't work with saddles anymore because that's what happened when I saddled him. So I'm just never going to saddle him again. It's like, no, you just teach him here's what this is, and here's the boundaries, and you can absolutely get that done with food, and teach your horse to be respectful and patient, and to wait for that reward, or that he'll only get that reward if he does X behavior. And so with the lay down, you are just shaping a series of tiny behaviors until it builds up into the lay down. So, you know, that would be, and you have to really watch your horse and say, well, what does he do before he lays down? Well, he lowers his head. So you might go out and click that. And then, you know, the next thing he'll do is he'll paw at the ground. So, okay, let's reward that. And the next thing he might do is circle. Okay, we'll reward that. So you just keep incrementally rewarding all these behaviors. And before long, your horse is going to be doing so many things that look like laying down that it's just going to enter his head like, oh, I should probably lay down. And so so that's how we get it there. And with the clicker, you know, there's endless possibilities on what you could teach. I use it to teach lead changes, to teach stop spins, all the reining maneuvers. I've used it a lot with my Road to the Horse Colt Guthrie and had a lot of great success with it. Exactly. Well, our next guest is one of the stars of the film Wild Horse Wild Ride, and some of you may know her as Extreme Wylene. Please welcome Wylene Wilson-Davis.
Hey, guys. Good morning.
Hey, how's it going?
How's it going? It's going great.
Don't you
great.
Wish you had about 50 minions to help you out, too?
I do. I think everyone wishes they had extra minions laying around.
Yeah, I do. I agree. I agree.
Yeah.
Well, some of you, if you guys aren't familiar with Wylene, I'm sure some of you have to be because she's been everywhere. She's had a lot of success. She does the Mustang makeovers, and I believe you won in 2009, if I'm not mistaken. And
yes,
that
and
was the ride
also...
that...
Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, you're fine. Well, that was the ride that was featured on the really cool movie Wild Horse Wild Ride, which is a documentary that followed a number of Mustang trainers and their journeys. And so what else have you done with the Mustang?
Well, just following that, while I was also filming Wild Horse Wild Ride, I was also training another Mustang. His name was Gator, and there was a Mountain Valley Mustang makeover in Cedar up in up in Utah, and I won that Mustang makeover just about a month and a half after Wild Horse Wild Ride was done. So from Fort Worth, I drove up to Utah and ended up winning that Mustang makeover. And then from there, you know, I just kept saying, okay, I'm not going to do another one. And then I know how I feel about that, Mary. I was like, okay, I'm not going to do another one. You know, I need to focus on other things. And then sure enough, I'd get pulled into, you know, thinking about it and contemplating, okay, let's do one more just to see what we can get and what kind of horse will come out of this show. And every year it just seemed like it just got better and better. And even Rembrandt, the horse that I had in Wild Horse Wild Ride, he was so talented and so good. And you know, you just don't think you can have one who's different. You know what I'm saying? And so it was just nice to actually each Mustang makeover, they're all different personalities, and it's just fun to have that uncharted territory where you get to start over and have just like this journey with this random wild horse. And currently I've trained 11 for the Mustang makeover. And, you know, and just last year for when ABC had contacted me about doing a reality show through their program, and they had come to me and said, you know, we're really wanting to do this reality show. And I was like, oh, I just don't know if I want to do it. You know, I'm not sure. And they were like, no, we really, really want you to. And then I ended up agreeing to do that. And then when I did, I by far got the best horse I've ever owned. I love him. His name's King of Hearts. And I showed him last year at the Mustang Million. And he was sixth place, right beneath old Mary Kitts Miller. So it was a really, really fun show. And then that ended up airing on Nat Geo Wild. And it was a lot of fun, and you know what? You just never know where you're going to be led, you know, and it just ended up being really neat. So I've really loved and appreciated being around the Mustangs. They've absolutely changed my life 100%.
Yeah, these makeovers, I don't know what it is about them. They are relentlessly addicting, And yes. I've been in the same boat, like, I need to move on. I'm in a different spot in my life, and I don't need to do another one. And then it comes around, and you're like, oh, my God, the deadline's approaching. I better get in. And, yeah.
That's exactly
and I've
true.
Kind of had, yeah, I've had a small fraction of the experience you've had of just going and doing a few of them and having some success. And not only is it just a blast, and the people are the best group of people you will ever show with. I can't tell you how many people I've competed against who they'll give you tips in the warm-up pen. And, if you need help with something, if you want to go ride with them, it's just a really great group of people. And, that show on Nat Geo Wild, that was called Mustang Millionaire. And that was a really great show. And that kind of followed some of the real, not just the big names, just about, it had a really good cross-section of what these competitors are and what they do and how they prepare. That's been a lot of fun. And then you and I just did a clinic in Hamilton, Texas in October. And that's kind of where I saw, we did something together in June, the Mustang Family Reunion. And I have to tell you, I saw this thing you were doing with your horses and that you were having your students do. And the first time I saw it, I was like, well, that's crazy. What is that? And so,
is that?
Yeah. So what I was looking at, we were at a clinic where there's several clinicians and we're all doing demos on different topics and participation clinics. And I'd look over at the arena and I'd see all these people leaning forward and touching their horses on the neck, like almost all the way between their ears. I'm like, what the heck is that? That didn't make any sense at all. And one of my friends rode over and she goes, oh yeah, this is what you do. And you teach your horse to stop by touching on the neck. So I thought, well, that's kind of fun. And by the end of the clinic, a lot of people could just reach down right in front of the saddle, touch their horse on the neck, and they'd stop. And I thought, well, that's kind of okay, I guess. And then when we did the clinic, we did the Triple Threat Clinic in Hamilton, I saw it again, and I thought, well, that might be pretty cool, but I just don't see me using it. And then I've had a young girl working for me, and she's been putting who has worked with Wyleen in the past, so she knows it, and it's called the basic handle, and she's been doing it on my colts. And so now it's something I'm like, okay, I got to figure out what this is. So why don't you explain exactly what this is that you're doing at clinics and why it works and who can use it?
Yeah, definitely. I've had several people come up to me and say, how do you get your horses to stop so nice without pulling on them? And it's something that I was raised doing. It's something I grew up doing. My mom, back in 1965, she not only college rodeoed, but she traveled around with a man by the name of Monty Foreman. And a lot of people might not know him. He died early in the 80s. But he was a horseman that was beyond his years, and he taught the basic handle, and it was that touch on the neck stop. And what he would do is, basically, you have to be able to put a handle on a horse, a young horse, and take them from wild to mild as soon as possible. Now, back in the 60s, there wasn't very much groundwork going around. You know that as well as I do. So he liked to just get on and go, and he would use this method to teach his horses. And so all that requires is that you take your reins, and the first thing you do is you just run your hand all the way up that horse's mane, and literally where your hand is touching the horse's mane. Then from there, you slide your hand and lead the horse's nose around and bend them to a stop. And when you do that, the more times you repeat that, the quicker the horse learns. Now, it is really foreign, and horses might not understand it in the beginning, just like anything. But the more times you repeat that, the faster, the quicker the horse picks it up. And before you know it, within just a few short hours, sometimes even a few short days, you can be going along on a loose rein and you can literally just drop your hand and have the horse come to a complete stop. Because the horse really just wants to know, is it forward, is it back, is it right, is it left? And so growing up, we used to do the basic handle on everything. And I rode crazy barrels and, crazy runaways, my whole life. But I could still have a handle on them, and that was the biggest thing. And so that's where I kind of developed my knack, if you will, for riding untrainable horses. And that's why the Mustang Makeover was so appealing to me, because I knew I could train one. And it's just really been successful, and I've had a lot of students who have seen it, but they were really skeptical. And but once they applied it, they really saw that it's really beneficial, and it does work. And the nice thing about it is you can take that basic candle and you can teach it just in those few, you know, maybe 2 weeks of the training, and then you can move on from there. But it's really nice to know that you have that connection, and you also have the ability to ask your horse first, hey, do you mind slowing your feet down? And when you do that, it's really, really great because you're asking the horse first. You don't just take it from him. So it's a really nice way to ask your horse. And I've seen big time changes in horses from clinics and just different private lessons. And so it's just been really rewarding to see it come full circle. And it's a lot of fun to watch it. And I like taking a horse that's a challenge and saying, okay, this horse has been running away for 10 years. How do we stop it? Instead of pulling back, we actually release the reins. And it's just kind of that reverse psychology on the horse. And they go, wait a second, aren't you going to pull on me? And then when you don't, they start figuring out, okay, you're talking to me. I need to listen and pay attention. So it's been really great, like I said. And that's where I get to touch on the next stop to step off of my horses when they're running wide open. And all those fun things that I do, it all starts with the touch on the neck first.
So it's, well, yeah, I think it's a great concept, and I'm always looking for tools for my tool bag, and so that was really appealing. And at first I saw the, you know, well, this is a fun novelty thing. And then, you know, riding my own colts, that Maggie, you know, my assistant has ridden and done this with, I was on one yesterday actually. And she kind of wanted to take off at a lope a little faster, and she was kind of building speed. I'm like, I need to shut you down. And I started to bend her around because that's typically what I do. And she was kind of grabbing the bit. And so I'm like, well, let's try this. And I put my hand down on her neck, and she buried her little butt in the ground. So
yeah.
I think it's a really fun thing to try. And I agree with you. I think colts especially, they're just looking for help. That's all they're looking for. And no horse really has an agenda. They're not trying to outsmart you or outwit you or get out of work or anything like that. They just need help. And so I think it's a really cool tool to put on your young horses as well as your more experienced colts.
Right. Absolutely. And, yeah. And you know, with the Mustangs, it really speeds up the process. I find that the sooner you get their feet moving, the faster their mind works. And then, if you have an idea of what you want to do, the horse is just looking for that leadership. And once you give them something to do with their feet, and then what I do is I'll speed them up, and then I'll just run my hand up their mane, and I'll just slow my body down and lead their nose and bend them to a stop. And then that can transfer into a rollback. And there's several other little different things you can do as a cue beforehand. And with that, even young horses, even old horses that have old bad habits, it's really nice to know that you just have those basic fundamentals underneath you before you go on to the advanced stuff. And that's why I really push and practice doing the basic handle just in the beginning to really give that introduction to the horse so the horse understands that you're the leader and that you have the idea in your mind and you know what to do. Because like you said, they're just looking, they're not trying to be mean or counterfeit or anything. They're just waiting for someone to tell them what to do. And I find that for me, it's the fastest way to get them going from being crazy wild into just being soft and mild. And that's what I really always look for.
Yeah. And, you know, as far as cues go and giving signals to your horse, I think a lot of people will agree, you know, when you teach your horse, and this is something I learned in training reining horses, when you teach your horse to stop or turn or any of those maneuvers, you never really want to rely too heavily on one cue. Like, you know, of course, my horses can stop when I pull on the reins. And they can stop from only pulling on the reins. And sometimes I'll really work on just that part of the stop. You know, can I just draw on you and have you respond to that and understand what that means? But a finished stop has 3 or 4 different cues. It's the relaxing of your seat. It's saying the word whoa. It's taking your legs off. It's drawing on them and getting them soft. And I think that's a key to keep a horse really soft is to have all of those signals to work off of and to work consistently off of. So you're not just pulling on your horse's mouth, you know, or you're not just saying whoa and hoping for the best. And it's really a good way to kind of build in a really solid foundation. And you have three or four different ways to help out your horse. So I see this as something, you know, just another signal I can give to help my horse. And I've even played with putting it on, you know, my older broke horse. Well, I've done it with my Sixes colt. And it's just something else. And where I see the application, for me personally, I'm like, ooh, this will really help with my bridleless.
Yeah.
Another cue. Yeah. We're not just relying on the bridle. So that's really fun. And I see it as a great way to help the rider's confidence. Have you seen a difference in your riders? I mean, we've talked about the horses.
Oh, yeah, no, absolutely. Because I've always said in clinics, you know, and I've traveled a lot and I've seen a lot of different clinicians out there and a lot of different riders and different expertises. And what's interesting to me is when I watch clinics, I never see anyone teach what to do when something goes wrong. Everyone teaches control and being perfect and having everything perfect. What I do in my clinics is I push you out of your comfort zone and I say, okay, when everything hits the fan, what are you going to do to stop your horse? How do you do that? Because it's nice to be pretty and have your horse in frame. But when a duck flies out of the bushes, what do you do? And we practice that. And I teach people how to fall off their horses by reaching up and grabbing their horse around the neck. Because when you go to, if and when a horse panics and they spook, the more you pull on them, the faster they run. And so we do this in clinics. I literally have people fall off their horse, grab onto the horse's neck, and slow the horse's feet down. And it's never not worked. And that's why I love using it as a demonstration. And so I love seeing people go, oh, my gosh, I know what to do now. It all makes sense, and I'm not afraid anymore. And then putting that into jumping and stepping off of their horses and standing up on their horses. Yes, their confidence absolutely 100% changes. And it's really neat to see them get that aha moment where they realize that it's worth it and their horse is worth it and they know what to do next. And so
you know,
I love seeing that.
Well, and that's by your extreme, Wylene. That's how you got the name, I think. But I like that because I'll tell you what, I've been to those clinics too, and we all watch, and everything's all perfect, and the clinician does not want anything to go wrong because it kind of makes them look bad. So they avoid that at all costs. Yet we're all out here riding when our horses aren't perfect, and I had a turkey fly out of a tree and land on my horse's head one day on a trail ride on the side of a mountain. I mean, fortunately, that horse didn't do anything. You know, he was good about it. Scared the crap out of me more than the horse. But, you know, that's the kind of things that do happen. My pony the other day bolted. It was the first time he bolted. I didn't know what to do with this particular pony. I'm not sure he knew what was going to stop him either. And those are the situations that are hard to prepare for, but there are certain things you can do, and it sounds like you're doing them. So good for you.
Yeah, we have a lot of fun doing that. And like I said, I push people out of their comfort zones, and they'll say, oh, I will never do this on my horse. And I'm like, if you come to a clinic, you are going to do that. And then at the end, they thank me because they're like, I needed someone to push me out of my comfort zone. And when you do that, then their confidence changes. And let me tell you, their horse follows suit. They go, okay, my rider knows what they're doing. I'm following them. But, of course, if you don't have leadership, then the horse just assumes that position and that role. And that's where you run into problems. And that's why horses get scared and they run off and buck and bad things happen because people don't know what to do. They just lock up and go into the fetal position and scream, you know. And so their horses really don't know what to do. So when you teach a horse what to do under pressure and when something goes wrong, you can get some really neat results. And I've seen it all across the nation, all over the place, you know, just I really like to take the worst situation and say, okay, we're going to teach you how to ride and guide right now. We're going to teach you what to do when something goes wrong. And then that builds their confidence, and it's really rewarding to see that.
That is cool. That is cool.
Speaking of, getting out of my comfort zone.
Mary, we're going to have you call back. Your connection just went south on us, so give us a call back. Let's do this. We're running out of time. Let's tell everybody where they can find you and what your schedule is.
Okay, well, you can find me on extremewylene.com. That is my website. I'm also on Facebook. I have a Wild West Horsemanship page on Facebook. and I'm actually preparing to have a baby. My husband and I are expecting our first baby in February, so I'm taking a few months off. Yeah, thank you so much. Yeah, we're really excited. And my last clinic was just about 3 weeks ago, and now I'm on full mom duty. And then from there, I always post my schedule on my website, and I also have a Twitter account. But Facebook is a great way to reach me as well. And if anyone has any questions, they can definitely email me through that. My email address, if you want that, is sugarpony@gmail. And that's sugarpony@gmail.com. That's where they can reach me.
Very good. Now, you know, my co-host on this show, Jamie, rode up until about 7 months, and then she was back on after a month. So do you have a target goal in mind for after you have the baby?
Oh, yeah, I'm sure I'll be right. I mean, I still ride now, and I'm about 7.5 months pregnant now. But I have two other children, and I was back on a horse as soon as I was able to get on.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think that's what keeps you in shape, quite honestly. So I'm excited for it, and the new 2015 schedule will come out, and we're always looking for new venues, new places to go, and that's why we'd come up with this triple threat clinic that Mary and Miranda did, and it was a really, really great time. And so we're always looking for new locations, and if someone decides they want to host the clinic, they always ride for free. So that's a good thing for these listeners to think about, and we definitely want to come out and help you. So just let us know how we can help, and we'd love to see you down the road.
ExtremeYlene.com is the website. Check it out. Thank you, and good luck with the baby.
All right, thank you.
The Equity Flexin Fork is a premium quality manure fork built in the USA to last for years. The ultra-tough, distinctive yellow basket is backed up by an unprecedented 13-month warranty against tine breakage. Patented flexible backbone lever releases stress so the tines don't snap and the dreaded tine flip will be a thing of the past. And the technology doesn't stop at the tines. The Flexin Fork also has a lightweight fiberglass handle and ergonomic grip. Available in regular and narrow tine spacing for sawdust, pellet, or rice hull bedding. You can check them out today at equitymfg.com.
Well, Jennifer, our next guest is ready, I think, right?
Yes, he is. We're just on the fly this morning. Good morning, Mark. How are you?
I am good.
Yes, Mark... Now, am I pronouncing your name correctly, Bolender?
Yes, it's Bolender, correct.
Oh, I got it right. Yay me. We would like to welcome Mark this morning. He is the guy that is responsible for many of the extreme trail and mountain trail videos that we all love to watch on YouTube. And look at those things and goes, those people are crazy. And we searched the interweb and dug Mark out of the mountains. And we're going to have him come on this morning and tell us a little bit about extreme and mountain trail. But to get a little background, tell us a little bit about Mark. And did you grow up as a horse guy?
No, I actually did not grow up as a horse guy. I started riding when I was 39 years old, the same age as Sally
Swift.
Wow. I loved animals, but horses were not on my forte. I found them to be fairly rude and scary. They were beautiful, but I didn't understand them.
There's a lot of horse husbands that agree with you, Mark.
What was it that spurred you to get into horses? Was it the classic case of a loved one said, "You're going to get into horses, or I'm not sticking around"? Or how did that happen?
No, it was a little daughter named Kendra who said, "Daddy, I want a horse." And one thing led to another, and we decided to do the family thing and all buy horses.
You're a brave man.
Looking back, indeed I was. Indeed I was.
So daughter's pony obsession morphed somehow into extreme trail and mountain trail. What happened there? That seems like a big leap.
It's a fun leap. It's a fun story. But what happened is almost right off after the first year I got it, I actually was bucked off of my horse and I broke my back. and that was about the same time that Christopher Reeves broke his, and that is quite sobering when you are in bed and can't move. And so I hired someone who now resides in Missouri, Steve Cornwell, who worked for me for 7 years, and his job was to train my two horses, teach me to ride, and go to a clinic and show every month around. And so we proceeded in a seven-year journey of great learning curve, and I was led a very active life of, snow skiing and water skiing on circuit and racing sailboats and in the martial arts, and I always had a coach. And so it was pretty natural when I got in something new to hire a coach, and it was the best move I ever made because he did teach me balance, and along with all the other clinics and everything else, I learned a lot. I mean, it's a tremendous amount, and the more I've learned, the less I know. And so I started showing all around, and then in quarter horses, and then reining, and then someone kept telling me I needed to go see this show down at Oregon, and I went down and took my horse, and I was hooked. I didn't do the best the first year I went, 2006, and 2007 I came back, and then 2008, 9, and 10, I actually won the national high point down there, and I did it bridleless, actually, on my horse, and then I won the Open Futurity in 2008 with Checkers, or 2009, then 2010, I won the Open, too, on another horse that I was training, because this goes on my sixth year now that I'm a trainer. And so the learning curve, has been steep. It's been concentrated. But anything I get into, I jump in with both feet. And it takes a lot of study. It's a very humbling journey. It takes a lot of reading. And you have to be open to look to other people for instruction also. But the mountain trail is just a magical new discipline, and it is awesome for cross training. I don't care whether you're jumping. We have a mountain trail course now that's one of the best in the world, and that used to be my jumping arena. All my beautiful jumps are gone, and now it's all mountain trail.
So how did mountain trail get started as a competitive sport?
Well, Major DeFour, down at the Oregon Horse Center, he owns the Oregon Horse Center, and they host many large breed shows in different various shows. And he was looking at a trail class one day, and he said to himself, that is not a trail class. You know, I know the trail because he likes to ride the backcountry. And so he proceeded to build a trail course that looked like a mountain. And he has lots of equipment. He brought in like 200 tons of rock and made ponds and bridges. And it's as you've seen, it's a true trail course. And the sport grew, and it just expanded tremendously. And so most of the spinoffs that I can trace down across the U.S., Canada, and Europe, they all can be traced back to that show there at Eugene, Oregon, and the difficulty. But Major, he encourages me, but he really has no interest in expanding beyond his one show. And I see the beauty of it, and that's why we have taken it upon ourselves to, do our best to march this across the U.S., Canada, and Europe, and now probably Australia and South Africa.
So for the five people in our audience who have not seen any of the videos on YouTube, paint a little picture of what a mountain or extreme trail competition is. So you took a standardized trail class that you might see at an AQHA show, which is held in a flat groomed riding arena, and there are some ground poles and maybe a place to back up. What does extreme or mountain trail look like compared to that for somebody who's not seen the videos?
Well, extreme mountain trail looks almost, at the Nationals, looks almost like you've walked into the mountains. There's huge rocks, and they are genuine rocks that are brought in with large equipment. There's 40 and 50-foot trees. There's mounds of dirt up to 20 feet tall, laced with logs and rocks. There are numerous logs. We're not talking about little poles. We're talking about logs, up to 18 inches through. We're talking about ponds that are up to their bellies. At times, you have logs floating in the ponds that you have to walk over. There's trenches that you have to ride through, and sometimes you have to duck, for there's logs above your head. There's bridges that you have to ride under, bridges you have to ride over. There's a waterfall that goes up about 20 feet, and it actually has a stream coming down it. I think they have 1,200 gallons a minute coming out, or 2,400 gallons a minute coming out. So it's quite the
does
stream.
It rain? Does they have a rain machine, too? That would be so cool to make it rain on you.
They don't have a rain machine, but the funnest thing is, at the last day of the show, you actually ride up and down the waterfall. It's a stream, but it's very steep, and it has rolling rocks, and you would think the horses can't do it, but those horses walk up and down that, the vast majority of them, without ever blinking an eye. And it's quite amazing what the horse can accomplish. But this trail course, and as you saw, there is one division, it's called the timed event, and so you are judged on your time, which is only 40% at times, and they change it. They're not real consistent there, and that's one thing that we want to do in the mountain trail is to be very consistent in the judging. But then your techniques and the finesse, that is judged at 60%. So you might win the timed event, but unless it's determined that your skill was correct, then you might not win. But yeah, it's a fantastic course, but for the most part, it's all done at a walk and a trot.
Now, Mark, I just have a technical question for you. Are you using regular shoes, or are you put Borium on them or to stop slipping, or what do you do?
No, you use a regular shoe just like you would go on a mountain trail ride. I've learned that if I take a rainer to make sure I pop off the sliders, put on regular shoes because
yeah, that'd be good.
There's often mud. Yeah, there's often mud. But no, you regular shoes work just fine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. So you don't need anything for, you know, like in driving, we put Borium on to keep it from slipping down the road and things. I didn't know with the rocks.
Yeah, well, actually, there is one section of the trail show that you walk down a 15-foot rock path, and they're all big rocks, just like on a real mountain trail. We actually train them here on our trail course. We have what we call a face and a wall. Each one's about a 10, 12-foot drop, and not quite vertical, but almost. And like yesterday at the clinic, you know, the horse is slick, yes. But they have to learn to slide down. And the practical application of that is here in the Pacific Northwest, it's often slick and wet and rainy, but you still go on a trail ride. Or if you're out on a cattle ranch rounding up some cattle and it rains, you don't turn around and go home because it's slick. So horses are actually trained to slide and control themselves. And most wrecks I've ever seen on the trail are when people panic and get in the way of what the horse can do.
Yeah, yeah.
I can see it now, Glenn. They're going to have the slalom for them next. Well, okay, everybody's getting to this sliding straight down
the right
bank. We're going to have slalom next. This is kind of crazy, Mark. These courses, obviously, are a labor of love. There is some serious amount of dirt moving and construction going on. You have to really like playing with big toys. How are the courses changed up from show to show? And what kind of work is involved with that kind of thing? Because, like you said, these are real boulders and real trees.
Well, they set this course in Oregon up twice a year. And then in November, you have the National, and then you have the Northwest. And so the courses greatly change between the two shows. For 3 days, they bring in heavy equipment, and they reconstruct it so it has a fresh look to it. The ponds are the same. The waterfalls are the same. Various obstacles are added for technical difficulty, because to be really successful at this too, you need a combination between a three-day event horse and dressage horse or quarter horse trail horse. You have to have that boldness and confidence and forward movement, yet with the finesse. But these courses are a labor of love, and the ones that I have been building around the U.S., Canada, and Europe, most of them take, the initial work is done in 4 to 5 days. And then it will take them, you know, a few weeks here and there to finish landscaping it and to tweak it and finish it. But those courses, some of them are just literally spectacular. And it depends what, when we build a course, we try to fit it into what the local terrain looks like. The one we just completed this year down in New Mexico for Barbara Windham by Santa Fe, it blends right into the environment. And it looks just like part of the landscape, and it's landscape with, you know, desert type of material and fauna. It's right by mm-hmm. the Rio Grande, and it's beautiful. And the one that we had, a couple we did down in Florida, I helped design and build one from Lynn Palm there at Ocala, and then her husband.
And so that
let me guess,
one
Mark,
looks like,
in Ocala, we live in Ocala, so let me guess. The one in Ocala had palm trees, rattlesnakes, and banana spiders.
Not quite. Actually, we built that, I think, in 2008, and they'd had that hurricane or big windstorm the year before, so we were able to get a lot of stuff. But you can look on Lynn Palm's website and see hers. But then I built another just stunning one at Palm City for Jack Peoples down there. And that one looks like a mini putt-putt golf. It's all sodded.
Oh, cool.
Palm trees. He did bring in palm trees and everything else. And, yes, there are alligators right by the pond there. So, but in Florida, you know, they're worried about earthquakes, but they don't worry about the crocs. So us people up here in the Pacific Northwest, we think they're crazy.
So Mark, I do have a question here, Jennifer. You said about the athleticism of the horses, you know, needing a three-day event horse and a dressage horse, and, you know, definitely a steady Eddie. What are you using mostly? Or is it mostly quarter horses, or are there other breeds popping in there?
Oh, we see absolutely everything. Size or shape is totally irrelevant to this. We have horses that are 18-2 that do this, and we have little ponies that do this. The critical thing is the mind, and the next critical thing is the mind of the person. I have more work to do to change people's concepts and allow the horse to do what it can naturally do, what its instinct will take over to do, and that always shocks people. But no, we have a lot of warm bloods actually that do this too. We did a clinic for Claudia Kojikar, who has some tremendous trainers and jumpers in Canada and the U.S., and a lot of those jumpers have fire in their belly, especially if they're jumping 6 and 7 feet, trust me. And they're large. But we have found out that if you don't insult the horse and you get into their mind, those little horses, they drop their little nose in the ground and they pick their way through those rock patches and through the logs just fine. And we have pictures, you know, to prove it. So, no, the breed is irrelevant. Yes, the Quarter Horse Association calls it trail challenges. And so we're hosting 6 AQH shows here at our horse park this year. In our courses around the world, we're also pushing the AQHA Trail Challenge, but that is also open to all breeds on that day. And so the most critical thing to success in this discipline is proper training. If it's done proper, it's very safe. On an average, for instance, it takes about 20 minutes to teach a horse to walk across the 33-foot balance beam, or about 10 minutes to teach him to walk across the swinging bridge plus do a 180 on it. And it doesn't really matter what temperament they have. And I like the ones with an attitude, a little bold and confident, and I don't mind that at all. I find that's very beneficial to this discipline. But they all have to learn to, you know, pace themselves and wisely pick them their way through the obstacles and not rush. And so I may have, if I'm judging, I may have a 17-2 hand horse that really is moving through the obstacles, but with total grace and with total control and with thinking its way through. And I may have the next little horse, 14-2, that takes twice the amount of time to get through it, and yet they're both correct. Or I may have a little horse that is rushing through it. It navigates that obstacle in the same amount of time as a large horse does, but it's rushing, so it will be scored very poorly. And so we really don't care what speed, as long as it's correct, as long as it's safe.
Okay, so it is a judged as opposed to a speed competition.
Yes, it is a judged. Okay. Speed is more of the Yahoo Craig Cameron stuff, and I've also participated in that, where that's a little more cowboyism, I would say, and it's fun. But this here is very distinct on the finesse and judging. It's very objectively judged. For instance, when you go into that obstacle, you either enter straight or you do not. You either break gate or you do not. You either go off center or you do not. So it's not subjectively judged. It's very, very objective. If you stumble, if you step out. So it's like reining. We know precisely, even riders know how you're judged. So it's not a beauty contest. It's not who you are. It's what the horse did.
Well, that's fascinating.
Now, go ahead, Jen.
My final question for you, Mark, because we're running short on time here. I could go all day on this, and now I'm going to have to make a trip to Oregon. If somebody's interested in getting started in this, are there different levels? Because it's obviously going to be one course, because you can't very well build these massive courses that are of natural terrain. You can't have one for each level like you would in a three-phase event where you have little jumps, medium jumps, and big jumps for three separate courses. How is that divided into levels for somebody who's a 9-year-old kid on a Shetland pony versus a professional trainer on a reining horse? How do the levels work in extreme
training? Well, we actually have three different levels plus the children's event within this too. And if you look on the AQHA website, you'll see we have level 1, 2, and 3. And so each course I design, you do want to be able to accommodate each level. Like on a large eventing field, you have different size jumps and different difficulty levels. And so the beginning jumpers, obviously, they're not going to go for the Grand Prix type jumps. And the same thing here, too, where the horses walk up and down in water on the courses we build, we will have different patterns for each level and different obstacles they master. For instance, the 33-foot balance beam, the only people that get to ride across that at our place are the open and the level 3 people. The other people, no, absolutely not. They might get to walk across a little low, you know, 12 or 14-foot balance beam. That's fine. It's not going to hurt if they fall off. But only the top people. So in each course, you have three distinct patterns and three distinct levels, plus the children's pattern. So, yeah, there is something for everything. And then at the big AQHA regional quarter horse shows that I judge and do clinics for, you know, we set up many obstacles. We don't have a trail course. So you don't have to have one of these magical trail courses to get involved in mountain trail. Yes, that's nice. Yes, it's always wonderful to go and have that experience. But you don't have to have it. You know, I encourage all of you to go over to Lynn's Palms and Cyril's and see what they have and participate and look at her website. You're down in Florida and then down at Palm City. But no, you don't have to do all the very tough things if you're just starting. And you can go from there. And this is open to English riders and Western riders. And that's the beauty of this. All ages, all disciplines, whether you're Western or English, and that's what we see hooking people. It's fun.
So all of our listeners right now who are sitting there typing furiously into Google trying to find more on this and stopping by YouTube to watch videos, where is the best place for our listeners to go to find out more and to become involved with this this really cool discipline?
I would say go to our website, BollenderHorsePark.com, BollenderHorsePark.com, or you can look at our Facebook or LinkedIn. There is not association right now. We're working on that as we speak to get that started across the international lines. It will not only be for the U.S., it will be for Canada and also Germany. Germany, we have a large following. They've started an association over there now, and we're working with them, and that's exciting, and we have more courses to build over there. But, yeah, go to our website or feel free to give me a call at 360-269-5699. Or you can also call my marketing manager, Lee Sampson, at 360-269-6156. And she's actually from Florida. She was from Palm City, and she'd always ridden English and jumpers, and she was fascinated and hooked on what she saw in this. And it's fun, and it's good for the horses. So, yeah, go to our website or give us a call. We're always happy to talk. Just remember, we're 3 hours behind you.
Yeah, East West Coast time, people. Well, thank you so much, Mark,
yes,
for stopping by and spending some time with us this morning before the sun came up in your part of the country. And this has been a fascinating conversation, and I'm sure that lots of our listeners are going to go out and check out Extreme Trail and become involved. And hopefully we'll be hearing from you again soon to tell us all about the Extreme and Mountain Trail Association.